Well, good morning. It's great to be able to share this material with you and to look at this subject, which I think is a really, really important one. I hope you've got one of these handouts saying Team Plenary Day Idolatry 1, and that will give you somewhere to make notes if you want to. I should say that there is a certain amount of material, biblical passages and other things. And if anyone doesn't want to have to kind of scribble everything down, I'd be very happy to send the PowerPoint slides to you or make them available. If that makes it a bit easier, you're not frantically trying to get everything down. I'm glad to be able to talk about this subject of idols and idolatry. I do think it's a very important one. I'm encouraged by the fact that increasingly I think people do talk about idols as a problem and use that because as a way of describing issues, because it is a very biblical category. There's a lovely little verse at the end of 1 John where the writer finishes, where the Apostle John finishes by saying, "Dear children, keep yourselves from idols." And there's a lot of debate about whether he's saying something completely new there, introducing a completely new idea, or whether he isn't reflecting on the whole of what he's done before in talking about the greatness of Jesus Christ, the uniqueness of Christ, the importance of right belief in Jesus, and right commitment to Jesus, right trust in Jesus, and right living out of the Jesus way. And then he's saying, as he finishes, "And actually, you need to keep yourselves from idols, which are the opposite of all these things." How does this affect us practically? Well, let me read a little narrative. When my girlfriend and I had been going out for a few months, we hit a rough patch. She was taking her finals and needed to focus on the exams. I was unsympathetic, and I wasn't the center of her attention every weekend. I got depressed and angry in rotation. She seemed more interested in the studies than in me. My mood dived. It reached the point where we were almost splitting up. Things came to a head one weekend when I had to fly off to Amsterdam on business. I remember having some time off and wandering around the Van Gogh Museum, not the most cheerful of settings, on the verge of tears. From the hotel, I rang an older Christian friend and agreed to go round to see him when I got back from the Netherlands. I warned him why I was coming. When I arrived at his house, we sat down with a cup of tea, the British approach to pastoral care, and I began to open up. He listened carefully and asked a few questions. Then he said, "I wonder if she has become more important to you than Jesus." I realized instantly it was true. I had made her more important to myself than him, and I started to invest in her all my hopes for happiness and security rather than in my Lord. I realized that this was the reason why I was so depressed and angry. Afterward, my friend shared that he'd been planning to say the usual comforting words about relationships breaking up, but that as I came through the door of his house, the Lord seemed to prompt the words about whether she'd become more important, rather nervously. That was my first real insight into what I would now call idolatry, putting anything else in the place that is rightfully God's and his alone, and then suffering the consequences. Well, that's the introduction to a little book I wrote on idolatry. And I'm happy to say that the person concerned is here today. So my little idol is out there, but we've worked through that, and in the end she became my wife. I do think that both for our Christian lives and the way that we serve other people, this biblical concept of idolatry is a really, really useful prism and grid. I think it helps us to understand God and to love him more completely. It gives us an understanding, a way of seeing our culture and being able to critique it better, understanding its inner dynamics. It helps us to understand the gospel and what the gospel does more fully. It's useful in our outreach because it gives us a category for understanding where people are coming from and why they're caught up in the things they're caught up in. It's helpful for understanding ourselves, as I found, and therefore being able to grow as people and as disciples. And I think it's very helpful in understanding our ministry of preaching, discipling, and pastoral counseling, all the other things that we do. It's not a complete answer to any of these things, but it is a very significant perspective and a very biblical one. And if we understand idolatry properly and the gospel in relation to idolatry, I think we'll be able to do all these things better. In this first session, we're going to be trying to define idols and idolatry. And the place we need to start is understanding that biblically, idols are substitutes for the true and living God. Substitutes for the true and living God. And just in summary then, we need to have in our minds the biblical picture of God as one, as unique, as alive, but also as invisible, and that rather pompous word, incorporeal. He doesn't have a body. God is a spirit, vast and infinite. We can't describe that. Our minds can't get around what that means. And this simply singular and amazing being, beyond our comprehension, but whom we can relate to, who is living and invisible and one, is the true and living God. And we are made to live in dependence on him, for a relationship with him, and to worship him. But that's the biblical background. What an idol is a substitute for the true and living God in our lives. And most, in the most basic way, idolatry is the false worship of substitutes for the living God. So we see this very much foregrounded in the Ten Commandments. God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. He's insisting he is the only God. And then making that insistence precise. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth below or in the waters below. So the creation of something which is visible as a God to be a substitute for the invisible God who cannot be seen. Immediately we're into this thing of invisibility and visibility and not having a body, being incorporeal, and having some sort of physical identity. What he's hitting on is this human tendency to want something we can see that's material like us, that is either a terribly incomplete representation of the true God, or simply a representation of something else, or just a created object. Something, in other words, that you can touch and feel and see and smell, as opposed to the God you can't do that with. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, he says, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. And we'll be picking up that later. I'm just going to flick over the next slide. And then in the history of the people of Israel, they've been brought out of the promised land. The Ten Commandments have been given. Moses disappears to have more time with the Lord, to be instructed by him. And then there's the incident of the golden calf in Exodus 32. It's very interesting. Right at the beginning, just after the warning, comes this incident. When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered round Aaron and said, come, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us out of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him. Aaron answered them, take off the gold earrings from your wives, your sons, your daughters that they're wearing, and bring them to me. So all the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron. He took what they handed him and made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then they said, these are your gods, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. And then Aaron sees it and he adapts to what's going on. He builds an altar and they have a festival to the Lord. So there's a huge amount of mixture here. Is this a representation of the true God? Is this something else? But you can see what's happening. An image is being substituted for the worship of God, which is not to be of an image. And then there's the whole description of it, and you know what follows. Psalm 106 reflects on that. At Horeb, they made a calf and worshipped an idol cast from metal. And then as we go through the Old Testament, we just see a succession of moments, a succession of patterns of idolatry in the history of Israel. See these descriptions of them worshipping. 2 Kings 17, they worshipped idols. Again, 2 Kings 17, they bowed down to all the starry hosts and they worshipped Baal. So not an idol in that situation, but worship of the created order rather than the creator. Again, later on, 2 Kings 17, even while these people were worshipping the Lord, they were serving their idols, a mixture there. What was it they were actually looking at with these Baal idols? Well, I'm no great expert on archaeology, but this is what I managed to dig up on the internet. These are all different representations of Baal, who is a Canaanite fertility god. And no doubt they had these little statues. We know that they did, that they worshipped. Another one that's often mentioned is Asherah. There are some which are a bit indecent. I think this is not too bad. But these were the Asherah poles. And again, there are fertility associations there. So idolatry is putting something else in the place of the true God, the living God, and worshipping that thing. The Old Testament then uses two metaphors for three aspects of that. And it's worth tracking this through because it gives us an insight into the psychological dynamics of idolatry. Two metaphors, one of which we can kind of split in half, or has two aspects to it. And that first metaphor is what one of the great writers on idolatry of recent times, Brian Rosner, calls the political metaphor. In other words, it's a relationship with someone who is in power over you. That should be God, but in fact they're making it into an idol instead. And with someone who is placed over you in the ancient Near East, they had a kind of overlord status, and you would trust them to look after you, rather as I suppose we trust the armed forces or the police or whoever it may be, to look after us. We trust a government. Well, we should trust. We'd like to be able to trust a government. Sometimes it's harder than others. This is the political metaphor then. And there are a couple of quotes here. Of what value is an idol carved by a craftsman or an image that teaches lies? For the one who makes it trusts in his own creation. He makes idols that cannot speak. Isaiah 42, those who trust in idols, who say to images, you are our gods. So this is what we characteristically do with idols. We put our trust in some power or thing to take care of us in some way, instead of trusting God. The other part of the political metaphor is that you don't just trust an overlord in the ancient Near East, you serve them. So there's a double thing going on. This person is in some authority over you, they take care of you, but you also have to serve them. And precisely the same thing happens with idols. I think I quoted this already. While these people were worshipping the Lord, they were serving their idols. And in terms of the dynamics of it, this is what happens in people's lives. They trust something, but because they put all their trust in it, they end up having to serve it in some way. That's therefore the political metaphor, misplaced trust, misplaced service, all as part of worshipping the wrong thing. But there's a third dynamic, and that's brought out by what Rosner calls the marriage metaphor. And this is about misplaced love. This is about what we desire, what we love, what we prize, what we cherish. It's a little bit more emotional and relational in many ways than the political metaphor, though the political metaphor is very important. And we find right through the Old Testament this use of the marriage metaphor to describe the relationship between God and Israel. And categories like adultery and divorce and unfaithfulness in relation to their following foreign gods. So we find it right at the beginning of the story in Exodus 34. Be careful not to make a treaty with those who live in the land, for when they prostitute themselves to their gods and sacrifice to them, they will invite you and you will eat their sacrifices. And when you choose some of their daughters as wives for your sons, and those daughters prostitute themselves to their gods, they will lead your sons to do the same. The language of unfaithfulness and of sexual immorality and of prostitution is being used of idol worship, the breaking of the marriage covenant. You see it too in Deuteronomy 31. The Lord said to Moses, you're going to rest with your ancestors, and these people will soon prostitute themselves to the foreign gods of the land they were entering. They will forsake me and break the covenant I made with them. But I think it was the prophet Jeremiah who had the deepest insight into this. Those were predictions that were coming. In Jeremiah's time, they were being fulfilled in the most terrible ways. And the people were worshipping idols and going after them and drawing the foreign religious systems and foreign political alliances into their own national life at great cost. And here we have Jeremiah giving the word of the Lord, just describing this. Jeremiah 2. The word of the Lord came to me and said, "Go to and proclaim in the hearing of Jerusalem, this is what the Lord says. I remember the devotion of your youth, how as a bride you loved me and followed me through the wilderness, through a land not sown. Israel was holy to the Lord, the first fruits of his harvest. All who had devoured her were held guilty, and disaster overtook them, declares the Lord." So that's the background, the marriage metaphor, the relationship between God and his people as husband and wife, as lover and lover. Very, very beautiful thing. But then he has to say, "Long ago you broke off your yoke and tore off your bonds. You said, 'I will not serve you.' Indeed, on every high hill and under every spreading tree, you lay down as a prostitute." That was Jeremiah. Then, of course, there's Hosea, who we could also have quoted, who had to live it all out in terms of his own wife's unfaithfulness to him in that extraordinary kind of prophetic life, not just prophetic words, but prophetic life. So idolatry in the Old Testament is worshipping a substitute for the living God, and that expressing itself in misplaced trust, misplaced service, and misplaced love. And I think it's important to try and get all of those things, that kind of grid in mind, because it's not a single thing. And as we understand idolatry in our own lives, some of these things may be more to the fore at other times, sometimes than others. I want to go on to give a little bit more of the Old Testament descriptions of what idols are like. But let me just stop at that point and see if there are any questions thus far. Okay, I'll keep going. If at any point you do want to ask a question, by all means, stick a hand up. It doesn't have to be a formal kind of lecture going on and on without interruption if you want to ask a question. Okay, here are some of the Old Testament ways of describing what idols are. And I think these words are worth hearing and letting drop down into us because they give us the picture of how they're seen. They are abhorrent and abominable. Abhorrent and abominable. And the reference is here, Ezekiel 14. "These men have set up idols in their hearts and put wicked stumbling blocks before their faces." Deuteronomy 32, "They made him jealous with their foreign gods and angered him with their detestable idols." The adjectives are carefully chosen. No one stops to think, Isaiah 44. No one has knowledge or understanding to say, "Half of it I used for fuel. I even baked bread over its coals. I roasted meat and I ate. Shall I make a detestable thing for what is left?" Strong language. Then another way of looking at them is to see them as worthless, vain, and empty. "I hate those who cling to worthless idols. As for me, I trust in the Lord. Because of all the sins Baasha and his son Elah had committed and had caused Israel to commit, so that they aroused the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, by their worthless idols." And then I couldn't resist this New Testament example, which picks up that idea of emptiness, and I'm sure Peter is echoing it. "You know, it was not with perishable things such as silver or gold that you were redeemed from the empty way of life handed down to you from your ancestors," which of course was idolatrous. It was a pagan religion. It was empty. Idols are worthless, vain, and empty. Isaiah in particular spends a lot of time debunking idols. Alongside of that, they are also silent and powerless. "Of what value is an idol carved by a craftsman or an image that teaches lies? For the one who makes it trusts in his own creation, he makes idols that cannot speak." Can we see the contrast between the living God who cannot be seen, but who does speak, and between idols who are just images and can't speak? and they're powerless. The gods of the nations are just idols, Psalm 96 says, but the Lord made the heavens. Again, the comparison. But then there's another side to idolatry, and I'm going to move a little to the New Testament here, but I'm sure that the Old Testament writers would recognize this, and it's a little bit paradoxical. You see, on the one hand, idols are portrayed as just statues. There is no Baal god behind them. And sometimes there's a bit of debate with scholars of the ancient Near East. Did they think that it was actually the idol itself that really was powerful? Or did they think that's just a representation of Baal, and Baal is kind of somewhere else? And I think the more sophisticated idol worshippers would have realized that the little statue was just a little statue. But nevertheless, it had something kind of invested in it, and it had a kind of connection to a real spiritual entity who was this very real god. That's certainly how the Greeks and Romans thought about their statues. And the Old Testament insists there is no Baal. There is no Asherah. All there is a statue and a whole set of bogus mythologies associated with them. But, and this is where the biblical picture has another dimension to it. There is a demonic world that uses statues and the concept of idolatry to enslave people. So there is a real spiritual dynamic there. It's just not the one you think that's there. And the classic text on that is in 1 Corinthians 10. Now, you could spend a whole day on this. I had a very close friend who wrote an entire PhD thesis on this, and I'm borrowing some of his material here. Let me just read the passage and then try to draw out the theme. This is Paul writing to the Corinthians about communion and about idol worship. Therefore, my dear friends, flee from idolatry. I speak to sensible people. Judge for yourselves what I say. Is not the cup of thanksgiving for which we give thanks a participation in the blood of Christ? And is not the bread that we break a participation in the body of Christ? Because as one loaf, we who are many are one body, for we all share in the one bread. Familiar words about communion. Consider the people of Israel. Do not those who eat the sacrifices participate in the altar? Do I mean then that food sacrificed to an idol is anything, or that an idol is anything? No. Okay. This is the one side of the paradox. On the one hand, the idol is nothing. The idol is just a statue, and there is not a real living God behind that, invisibly somewhere. No, but the sacrifices of pagans are offered to demons, not to God. And I do not want you to be participants with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons too. You cannot have a part in both the Lord's table and the table of demons. And then very interestingly, what category does he invoke? What does he bring in? It's jealousy. Isn't that the marriage metaphor coming in? Are we trying to arouse the Lord's jealousy? Right back to the Ten Commandments. The jealousy of the Lord in connection with idolatrous worship. And so we draw these two things together and realize that there is a spiritual dynamic. There are spiritual forces in idolatry. They're just not the ones we think are there. They are demonic. And that means that idolatry has a kind of power about it. It's just not the kind of power we think it has. We'll be exploring a little bit about what that is in a moment, but let me just stop there and see if there are any questions, and then I want to give you a moment just in pairs to have a think about where we've got so far. But any questions? Okay. Good. I'd like you to spend a moment in pairs asking yourselves, what is the effect of these descriptions and definitions of idols on us? How does it affect us? What's our immediate response to hearing this? Just a couple of moments in pairs and then we'll resume, but I think it'll probably help you to keep on track if you get a chance just to reflect on where we've been. probably come down if you want. Well, why don't we resume? I've been trying to suggest to you that on the one hand, there is this terrible emptiness about idolatry, but on the other, there is a hidden power of a kind that people don't realize that's there. I do think that's the biblical, the paradox of the biblical presentation of idols and the subtlety of it and the subtlety of how they operate in our lives. And I want to come on now and look at some of the biblical material about what idols actually do to us, what idolatry actually does to us, given that there is this power behind it. And then we'll also think about what it does to God and what it produces in him. And then it'll be time for some coffee. Idolatry deceives us and ensnares us. People do not realize what it is doing. They are just caught up in a force field of delusion. I think that's a phrase Tim Keller uses for it. And they just don't have insight. Karl Marx called it false consciousness. He used it of what he saw as workers in factories being happy when actually they shouldn't be. And actually, interestingly, Marx borrowed the language of idolatry quite extensively, but we won't get into that now. But in a similar way, idol worshippers are deceived by the idols and what lies behind them, the demons. And the picture the Bible uses for that is to be snared by them, trapped by them. They worshipped their idols, which became a snare to them. Idols are out there to trap us. But in the end, it will always disappoint us. I didn't have a Bible reference, but I've just found one on the spur of the moment, which seems to work. So that's nice. Isn't God good? Isaiah 44 and verse 10. Who shapes a god and casts an idol which can profit nothing? People who do that will be put to shame. In the end, idols will disappoint us. We may be caught up in a false consciousness where we think we're all right for a long time, but in the end, an idol will get to you. A significant part of the biblical teaching on what idols do to us is in this next section. And I'm relying quite heavily on some brilliant work that's been done by an American scholar called Greg Beale, who occasionally pops up in Cambridge. Idolatry dehumanizes people. It dehumanizes us. It degrades our humanity. And there are a number of passages that show that. One of the classic ones is Psalm 115. This is talking about idols. They have hands but cannot feel, feet but cannot walk, nor can they utter a sound with their throats. He's talking about statues, pretty obvious, really. But then this is the killer bit. Those who make them will be like them, and so will all who trust in them. I've got a kind of double slide there, so I won't repeat that. Greg Beale's written a book called We Become What We Worship, in which he traces this theme that we've just seen from Psalm 115. All the way through Scripture. Some of his application of the theme is a little bit overdrawn, I think. I remember him preaching on Isaiah 6 here, and some of the people afterwards were wondering if he wasn't finding a bit more in the passage than they'd ever seen. But overall, the theme is spot on and terribly important. It's just he tends to find it in more places than perhaps it is, at least some people think. We become what we worship. If we worship the living God in spirit and truth, we become increasingly like him. If we worship something else, we become more like that thing. And because it is not the living God, and because it is just something which is dumb or created, we will be diminished in our humanity and degraded as people, dehumanized. You can see this dynamic operating in Romans 1 in Paul's great description of what happens with idolatry. Although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him. But their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like a mortal human being and birds and animals and reptiles. Isn't it a terrible thing to become a fool? Human beings were made to be wise and to draw their wisdom from their Creator. But as we fail to worship him and put him in his proper place, and as we put other things in his proper place, we are diminished. And there's an inner darkness there. And we think we're wise, we claim to be wise, but actually we're idiots. And we fail to see that the glory of the immortal God, who is just so great. I was trying to describe it earlier, and you could tell I was just struggling. I do find it hard to find the words because they are so inadequate to describe the infinite, supreme greatness and glory of God. And what are you worshipping instead? You know, a little statue or a little created thing of some kind. That dehumanizes us. And then finally, it destroys us. again, I found a helpful Bible verse here. It was in the same bit of Isaiah 44. And verse 11. People who do that, shaping gods, casting idols, will be put to shame. Such craftsmen are only human beings. Let them all come together and take their stand. They will be brought down to terror and shame. In the end, putting something else in the place of the living God destroys you. And there's no other word for it. It's a terrifying pattern of the power that these things can have, that idolatry, this activity can have if we let it. But the Bible also portrays it as having an effect on God. And prime among those effects is jealousy. Now, immediately, this is kind of problematic for us because we think of jealousy as being a sin, and it is a sin. Many of the ways in which we are jealous are sinful. But there is a right kind of jealousy. And we need to realize that the jealousy being described here is as part of the marriage metaphor for the relationship between God and his people and as a framework for understanding what idolatry does. So we go back again to the Ten Commandments, where he says that if they worship other things, he will punish them because he's a jealous God. And then that is expanded in chapter 34, just a little bit later, after the golden calf incident. Do not worship any other god, for the Lord, whose name is jealous, is a jealous God. And that jealousy is simply the jealousy that any married person should have about their husband or wife. Because marriage is about an exclusive commitment. And there's no room for mixture. And I think we all know that that is absolutely right. Now, that jealousy can become sinful at times and exaggerated and suspicious and all sorts of things. Of course, it can in fallen human beings. But the marriage commitment is an exclusive, lifelong commitment. And it's right to be aroused to jealousy if someone betrays that. That's just not simply a normal emotional response. It's a correct moral response because it is based on God's response to people whom he loves and whom he wants to have a relationship that will be a blessing for them as well as satisfying for him. And idolatry arouses his jealousy. And that's what we find in the writings of the prophets. I've probably got slightly too many Bible verses here, but let me read one or two of them. We've had this already about the description of the initial relationship and this lovely picture, the devotion of your youth. How as a bride you loved me. Israel was holy to the Lord, set apart for him. And then what happens? It's mournful and poignant. It's like a sort of jilted lover's song. What fault did your ancestors find in me that they strayed so far from me? They followed worthless idols and became worthless themselves. Do you see that again? You become what you're like. You follow a worthless idol, you become worthless yourself. They did not ask, where's the Lord who brought us up out of Egypt and led us through the barren wilderness, and so on and so on. I brought you into a fertile land to eat its fruit and rich produce, but you came and defiled my land with the idolatry and made my inheritance detestable. The priest did not ask, where is the Lord? And then he goes on. Have I been a desert to Israel or a land of great darkness? Why do my people say we're free to roam? We will come to you no more. Does a bride forget her jewelry? A bride her wedding ornaments? Yet my people have forgotten me. Days without number. It's worth dwelling on this for a bit. We remember that God's emotions are not like our emotions. Well, they are some. There are some resemblances. They're not identical to ours because God is God and his life is different from ours. But the Bible portrays him as having a jealous reaction to human idolatry. And just a little New Testament reference too, 1 Corinthians 10 again. Are we trying to arouse the Lord's jealousy? So this applies to us. It also arouses his righteous judgment, and a righteous judgment that comes in time. Once again, we go to Romans 1 because this is such a classic passage. I've already read the first few verses about how they didn't glorify God. They claimed to be wise, but they exchanged the glory of God for images. They started worshipping created things instead of the Creator. What happens? God, his righteous judgment, falls on the human race in time. Therefore, God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. They exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. There is a giving over. There is a judicial condemnation and judgment in time. Every society experiences this in its own special ways. Paul describes how it affects sexual immorality. God gave them over to shameful lusts. Even their women exchanged natural sexual relations for unnatural ones. In the same way, men abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. And what he's describing here is male and female homosexuality as God's righteous judgment on a society which has given up the worship of the true God. I can't read the passage any other way. I don't think you can either. And then he goes on, because it isn't simply homosexuality, and there's a very long list of other things that follow. So this is a real-time experience. But then, of course, there is the final judgment, because God doesn't simply judge in time. Judgment in time is a kind of insight into what will follow, for what will follow will be far, far greater. This is just one example. He said to me, it is done. I'm the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty, I'll give water without cost from the spring of the water of life. To those who are victorious, I'll inherit all this, and I will be their God, and they will be my children. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, the vile, the murderers, the sexually immorality, those who practice magic arts, the idolaters, and all liars, they will be consigned to the fiery lake of burning sulfur. This is the second death. Now, I know idolatry is there picked out in a list of other sins, and at that point it's not being used metaphorically. We'll think about the metaphorical use of idolatry after the break. But it does show how all idolatry will be punished finally one day for those who are not safe in Christ. It is a very, very sobering picture. And to preach through Hosea, which I haven't done, but Jeremiah, which I have done, and Isaiah, which I am doing, And to see God's response to patterns of idolatry is a deeply sobering experience. And it's why I think those books are given, particularly Isaiah and Jeremiah, in such bulk and density and apparent repetition. They're actually, because they're geniuses as prophetic poets, the repetition fills out all sorts of dimensions and affects us in different ways. But they are significant books because they portray for us God's response to idolatry and his hatred of it. But the glorious thing about those books and all the other portrayals of idolatry is that they also show God's grace and God's redemptive plan to do something about men and women who put other things in his place, and not simply to judge them, wipe them out, and start again. And again, you get these beautiful phrases about how God wants to reverse the pattern of idolatry and call people back to the living God. There's a great example. I think I'll use this and then maybe come back to Isaiah. In Ezekiel chapter 14, if you have a Bible, why don't you turn that up? I haven't got it on the screen. It's a stunning little chapter, and it's funny how it gets missed. I never knew about it, really, until I read a book called Idols of the Heart, and then I noticed it properly for the first time. And even in the BST, which is a very good one on Ezekiel, it almost gets passed over. Some of the elders of Israel, Ezekiel 14, verse 1, came to me and sat down in front of me. Then the word of God came to me. Son of man, these men have set up idols in their hearts and put wicked stumbling blocks before their faces. Should I let them inquire of me at all? Therefore speak to them and tell them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Whenever any of the Israelites set up idols in their hearts and put a wicked stumbling block before their faces and then go to a prophet, I, the Lord, will answer them myself in keeping with their great idolatry. I will do this to recapture the hearts of the people of Israel who have deserted me for their idols. We notice idolatry being portrayed as a heart issue, not simply an external one, and we'll be exploring that a bit more after the break. The diagnosis is of hearts which have gone astray. And then this lovely phrase, I will do this to recapture the hearts of the people of Israel. God's great redemptive plan is to recapture our hearts away from idolatry and to bring our hearts back to where they should be, which is the worship, love, service, and trust of the living God. We see it in Isaiah 2, don't we? I myself have said, how gladly would I treat you like my children, and give you a pleasant land, the most beautiful inheritance of any nation. And he goes on, return, faithless people, I will cure you of backsliding. And there's their confession. And he says, if you, Israel, will return, then return to me, declares the Lord. If you put your detestable idols out of my sight and no longer go astray, and if in a truthful, just, and righteous way you swear, as surely as the Lord lives, then the nations will invoke blessings by him, and in him they will boast. Israel's summoned to return, to come away from the idols, and to become what they should have been, which was the light to the nations, the descendants of Abraham, bringing a blessing to the peoples of the land from Genesis chapter 12. Well, we have a few minutes before the break. Let me just see if there are any questions, and then we'll get into groups again and just have a think about an aspect of what we've been looking at. Does anyone like to ask? Anyone like to ask a question? I'm sorry, the... they're all in a bibliography. Oh, I beg your pardon. I think Jeremiah and, in a way, an awful lot of the Old Testament is about this, and a pattern of idolatrous worship is there all the way through the narratives of Kings and Chronicles, and you can trace that. And then you get the prophetic commentary on that, which I think in a profound way you get in Jeremiah. You get the marriage metaphor portrayed very powerfully in Hosea, but it's also there in the early chapters of Jeremiah. In Isaiah 2, Isaiah also, there's a lot about political alliances in Isaiah, but that's interpreted, I think, as being a way of portraying the law that is like idolatry. And in the later chapters of Isaiah, from 40 onwards, there's a huge exploration of what idols are like and why idolatry is stupid. Why don't you split into pairs or groups, or do this on your own if you like, and just look at a single verse, Jeremiah 12, verse 13. Jeremiah 2 and verse 13. Which is a kind of picture of what idolatry is like when people worship false gods. And just explore in a discussion with each other, or just think about it on your own, what this says to us about idolatry. And then we'll stop at 11 for some coffee.